You're listening to Discovering Truth with Dan Duvall. Hey friends, welcome back to Discovering Truth with Dan Duvall. I am here with two new friends, and we're going to be introducing them to you guys. The first is Carrie Sherato, and she is the co-founder and executive director of Reclaim 611. Their website is reclaim611.org. She is also a nurse practitioner. And I met Carrie at a recent event I was at, America's Future, up in Ohio, and she was given a presentation on signs of abuse that medical practitioners will see when they are inspecting survivors of trafficking and so forth. And she has some awareness of satanic ritual abuse as well. And we got to talking, and what I found out is that she already knew me. And she told me the reason why, and that is because of the other guest that's joining us today. And her name is Amy Ogden, and she is a trainer and consultant for Carrie Grace Consulting. And they go around and do trainings for emergency stabilization through emergency housing. And so both of them will be on today talking with me about matters facing survivors of human trafficking and those that are coming through human trafficking with a background of satanic ritual abuse. And so, welcome, ladies, to Discovering Truth with Dan Duvall.
Thank you, Dan.
You know, Carrie, I'm going to just go ahead and get started with you and let you tell us a little bit about the cross-section between your medical background and your developing awareness of the problems faced by those in human trafficking and then those that have satanic ritual abuse at work as well.
Well, that's a really good question. And it is definitely a developing awareness. My background is I am a nurse practitioner, and I graduated, undergrad nursing school in 2005, and I worked all emergency medicine since then. And so I've worked in large metroplex. I work in DFW. I've worked for three major, health universities, facilities, and I've done a number of different jobs, within urgent care and emergency medicine. And I never, and this is kind of part of my story, I never heard the words human trafficking in undergrad, graduate, postgraduate, or hospital type of facilities. And we do a lot of continuing education as just part of our certifications, and never heard the words human trafficking. So I really heard human trafficking probably around 2009, and it was something I heard in a church, and I just didn't really understand what I was hearing. And it really had more to do with child exploitation. And when they were talking about it, I remember asking the lady, like, what country do you guys work in? And they just looked at me like this poor little blonde girl and was like, no, honey, this is like a Dallas-based organization. And there were a number of things like right after that happened that God just really just beautifully broke me. And I knew that I had been called to something when it had to do with trafficking, but I had absolutely no idea what that meant. And I really generally mean like I had absolutely no idea. And I think you probably both would agree with me that like in 2009, when you would, Google human trafficking, it was very slim to none. There was big statistics, but there was just like people don't really talk about it that much. And so I really didn't really understand it. And years went on, and I felt like God would just remind me of this topic. And I would always be like, well, what do you want me to do? Like, I'm here. I'll do what you want me to do. And, it never really materialized. There was just a lot of other things God had me doing, going back to school. And I started working in one of the largest trauma facilities in the emergency department here in the Metroplex, and which is interesting that God placed me there, inner city medicine. And I did not want to do that. Let's just put that out there. It's not really what I wanted to do. But that is really where he led me. And so here we are a couple years into doing that. And the Lord starts bringing up human trafficking again. And I'm listening and I'm like, okay, like, what are we doing now? Like, so two colleagues of mine that are co-founders, we started like looking in the community, like how to get involved, what to do, and nothing that had to do with healthcare. And then one of my colleagues was doing a continuing education for pediatrics. And there was something that came up that was about exploitation in children. And because we had just been really talking about this, she sends it to us and we're like, wow. I mean, in healthcare, we had never cross-referenced those two. Like, that's not where our brains were. And so that was just kind of like that God moment where it was like, no, this is where I want you to focus. This is your lane. And so really long story short, it just turned into a nonprofit kind of situation. Well, how else do we do this? Nobody really cares about what we're talking about. Most people don't understand what we're talking about. And how do we help our own profession? Because, so interestingly enough, we pulled all protocols from mm-hmm. all the major hospitals in our Metroplex that we had access to and looked at the protocols for domestic violence and for child abuse. Mm-hmm. And there was no protocols on human trafficking.
Now, that's so fascinating. Human trafficking
weren't even there.
And that's so fascinating because the reality is in Texas, both Dallas and Houston are major hubs of trafficking. And it is, there's a lot. And I mean, from children to people that have been brought over the border in droves now. I mean, we talk about the underground tunnels in Dallas and the amount of traffic that happens there. I used to live in Dallas for several years, and oh my gosh. So to have nothing.
No, wow. There was one pediatric facility, which I will say that I think the word exploitation was in a definition not of trafficking. It didn't say trafficking at all, but of abuse. And it mentioned exploitation, but that was not mapped out. And when we're talking about a protocol for human trafficking is its own entity. It is a form of child abuse, but it's so much more than that. But that is a completely different response than child abuse and mm-hmm. domestic violence. And so that is just not well understood in the medical community, like hands down. And that was very clear. And so this really just was a complete grassroots effort. I will tell you, like, I remember at like 2 or 3 a.m., in the ER one night, like probably right when Reclaim became actually Reclaim and we were really getting some momentum and really just being a student of the problem. We got involved in coalitions. We started meeting people, law enforcement. Like, we didn't under so much gap in understanding, and we're all still learning because the complexities are just, we always have to stay students of this problem. But at the same time, like, just really diving in. And I remember sitting at like 2 or 3 a.m. with two of the medical directors at our facility, and we were really slow that night. And so I was like, maybe I should just bring it up. Like, I wonder when I say human trafficking, like, what's going to happen? And so I remember asking them, like, hey, do you guys know what human trafficking is? And they were like, kind of step back in their seats. They were like, well, not really. Like, what do you mean by that? And I was just like, so I explained it. And I was like, these are the signs of someone being trafficked. Like, would you even know? Would that be in your differential of thinking? If you saw these different things, like, would you even think trafficking? And they were like, no, not at all. Like, we don't really know what you're talking about. So I just got to like kind of lecture them for like, in a nice way, of course, for like 15, 20 minutes. And I just remember them both sitting there staring at me like full attention. If you know ER physicians, you got like 2 minutes. to get their attention, to focus, and to get to the point. And they sat there and listened to me for 10 or 15 minutes. And they were like, what do you even do about something like this? So that really just sparked in my own department, just kind of being an educator about it. And that is where we started running into cases, because people were like, I remember when I remember one of the first cases we had was a colleague of mine who was like, hey, remember like 2 weeks ago when we were sitting back in a pod and you were telling me about trafficking and the signs of it? And like, could you tell me about that again? Because I think there may be a case here. And I was like, well, tell me what's going on. And so they did. And I was like, that's absolutely trafficking. And they're like, well, what do we do? And I happened to just be going into my shift later that day. And I was like, hey, I'm going to actually come down there now. And so we had just started developing protocols, our organization, and like with law enforcement and other NGOs and stuff like that. So I came down, and just based on education alone, honestly, Dan, just being self-educated, I could tell you that there were two victims. There was one pimp, one was a bottom girl, one wasn't, and that they were probably being interstate trafficked. Just by talking with them, talking to registration, asking what they got, information they got from them, and then taking the one, you know, the victim that I thought would be the most likely to break through to maybe talk to and build some rapport with. And she told me, I just really want to go home. And I was like, where's home? And she told me it was like in DC, and she's in Texas. She had been in Dallas for less than 24 hours.
Whoa.
They had both been sold to a Dallas buyer for like $2,000 each. He raped both of them, didn't use didn't use a condom, and they were all there for kind of vague symptoms, but really just to get tested, just to get like prophylactic treatment, which a lot of times is why they come in. But the pimp came in too, and he was going back and forth between the rooms, checking on the girls. And that's where the staff actually was like, that's kind of weird. Mm-hmm. So they had no idea. After this whole thing went down, we actually were able to call agents, get her in a safe place. They called her parents. They're in the ER department. And the cops, the PD, came and detained both the other survivor, which she was probably a bottom girl, but because she was part of it, they arrested both of them right out of our department for questioning. So that was literally there was nothing set in stone. There's no protocol in our department. That is just being one person educating people around me. And people after that case in particular, people were like, how in the world did you know that's what it was? And it's really simple. It's really just, I educated myself. I'll be really honest. I used what was out there, and we educated ourselves. And so it's not that complicated. It's literally just awareness and education opens your eyes, and all of a sudden you can see it everywhere.
So from that point, you had kind of moved into reclaim611.org and this website, but you started to map out a protocol and response for medical professionals. Yes.
Like, you could go on our website and there's a whole like template protocol, and you could just take it, download it. It's free, and you could just plug in your specific community resources. And it's been really well vetted by a lot of people. We just felt like people needed a template. There's a lot of discussion, a lot of organizations that talk about human trafficking protocols, and that is just a buzzword in medicine, is protocol, because that keeps all of us safe. That's how we run. That's like what medical professionals do. We run off protocols. And so that's something, that's the language, right? Yeah. And so we just felt like we needed to develop something that someone could take and just run with it. And we've already kind of done that research. We kind of already know what needs to happen. And so somebody else doesn't have to do that. They can just take what we've used and what we've developed and use it in their facilities.
No, that's so good. And that's one of the reasons why I wanted to have you on this podcast, is because people need to know that there are resources. I'm continually blown away by the people that listen to this podcast. Like, who would have thought you'd be listening to my podcast? But it is true. And so, you know, you interview people, you bring people on, you connect resources. I want to let you talk about this because we're going to inching towards where Amy comes into this conversation. But what were, I guess, some of the more basic, I guess, just common sense, maybe a few examples of common sense elements of those protocols you guys have put together, and a couple examples of things that weren't necessarily so intuitive, like, you would think you'd do this, but actually it's this. Can you give us a couple examples in both buckets?
Yeah, 100%. So more obvious would be like, why would a trafficker drop their victim off in need emergency help or just needs medical care. And that's going to be STIs, sexually transmitted infections, urinary tract infections. It's going to be lacerations. It's going to be trauma, pregnancies. And when they are at their absolute worst, when they no longer can work and they have no other option than to get the medical care. And so if you're going to see it in a facility or a hot medical place, you're going to see trafficking, you're going to see it in the emergency rooms, you're going to see it in OB, and you're going to see it in trauma and ICU. And those are your three major buckets. And so kind of knowing those complaints, things that look like domestic violence, which a lot of medical professionals already have to do all of these, you know, CEs and understanding of child abuse and domestic violence. So that same thing can mimic it. So knowing all of those things, the stories that don't add up, they don't make sense. Well, there's a reason why they don't make sense, right? Like, so all of that kind of education, the more obvious things, and then just the nature of the crime, which is obviously sexual. And abusive. So just all of those things that it could be, or affect your body. And then the major things, two major things. One is a misunderstanding of HIPAA as a healthcare person, and something that I really had to learn myself, because HIPAA was never created to protect a crime. Human trafficking is a crime. And we are supposed to report it.
Yes.
So, first of all, if you're a minor, if it's a minor, we're talking about child abuse. As a mandatory reporter, it is if you are suspicious or confirmed abuse. It is the same for trafficking. Suspicion or confirmed abuse. We report on suspicion for child abuse. So if you are suspicious of human trafficking, you should also make a report. It may not look straight up like, you know, child abuse. But if you are suspicious for it and you are educated on it and you see some signs and you're concerned, you should be reporting it. That's a little bit more straightforward because it's kids and people are kind of like, if I think something's going on, they don't really have a problem reporting it. It's not so much of this turmoil that people go through. But adults, and I've had a lot of kickback from this in some pretty significant areas, is that if an adult tells us that something's going on and they describe being a victim of a crime, but they don't want help, they don't want help, then in some aspects, we can kind of step back and it's kind of understood, well, we don't have to make them report it. That's true. They could be telling me and explaining and describing being a victim of a crime, and they're like not going to report it. They don't want to. Why? Because they're so fearful, which you two both know. Like, number one reason is because they're scared and they don't want to report it. You cannot force it. But that doesn't mean that we don't report it. I don't have to tell my patient that I'm going to report it, but I can anonymously. There's so many tips lines. FBI has one. HSI has one. Those tip lines, it is our job. It is actually against the law to not report a crime that we are suspicious or confirmed of. And it's the same thing as, like, if you think about like a domestic violence, somebody's like, you know, my husband hits me every day, blah, 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 this is going on. And you're trying to get her to, you know, report. She doesn't want to. Obviously, lots of fear. And they tell you, I'm scared if I go home, he may kill me. But I'm not going to report it. And you discharge that person. Okay, great. What if he kills her? What if he kills her? And what if they go back and they look and they do all this, you know, all their background stuff, and they say, oh, well, in the last 12 hours, they went to this facility and they were seen by this provider. And we've documented our concerns for domestic violence, because typically in a hospital setting or facility, you've documented your concerns. You've probably even got social work consult. You've done all these things. So there's probably going to be documentation of concern of abuse or confirmed abuse in your chart, and you never reported it. that comes back on you. You knew they were going to be a victim of a crime. They described it. So HIPAA was not created to protect a crime, and I don't think people understand it. So it's very underreported, especially for adults in the healthcare setting, because first, I just don't think they understand. Second, as I think they have any idea where to report it. And every city, every place has, I mean, there's national, you know, Homeland Security, FBI, they're all national organizations. So you can go on and just look up their tips line and you can report it, and that is not going to come back on you.
Mm-hmm.
So I will say,
go ahead. Finish your thought.
Well, I was going to say that is probably one of the bigger things I didn't really understand that, and I think does inhibit reporting cases in the medical profession.
So where did your interest in emergency stabilization through housing come in?
That's a great question. So because whenever I would have a victim as a patient and we needed to have them in a safe place, there was nowhere to go.
Tell me about it.
I mean, there's nowhere to go. Not for emergency stabilization that was specific for trafficking. It's always the shelters. It's a whirlwind. It depends what social worker you have on that day, whether they even have knowledge about the trafficking resources. So that became my challenge as well. Like educating them and giving them my resources and like, hey, did you know about all these places? And they're like, no. Not having a place and not somebody to actively respond, which I don't want to over talk about this, but you know, in healthcare, we're really busy people.
Mm-hmm.
We got a lot going on. We may have a lot of patients, and some of them may be very critical. And if your victim is not critical in that sense, you know, they're stable, human, you really need somebody who knows trafficking, who understands trauma, to come in and be an advocate, especially if they're going to be there a long time, especially if they're going to need, like, they're going to be reporting or they're going to be doing, asking multiple questions, which we all know is re-traumatizing, just to keep a sense of calmness and security and building rapport. And that doesn't exist either. There are people who do it, but they are always, there's like slim to none.
Mm-hmm.
And so having advocates who come into healthcare and help healthcare respond when they don't have the capacity to do it is one major gap. And then the next one is just finding them a place to go. And so most of the time they would end up having to go to a shelter. But as we all know, when you tell a victim of trafficking, their option is a shelter, they're like, nah, I'm not going.
So this is kind of where you enter the conversation, Amy, because you have experience in emergency housing. So why don't you walk us into that experience and where that finds a cross-section with satanic ritual abuse survivors?
Sure. So, well, back up a little bit. Carrie and I met through, we were training her organization in safe house, emergency safe house stabilization. And we had started going, we're having to turn away cases because they're SRA and we weren't technically trained in SRA. And then Sula Lyell came and trained our organization. And that's when we started. Yes.
I had Sula on this program. I'm probably going to have her back at some point too. Wow. Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
Yeah. And so it was fascinating to me because before Sula had come in to train our organization, I don't even know how I started stumbling upon SRA, but I just was so hungry and thirsty to know all I could know about it. In that Total Mind Control Slave book, I'd started reading that. And when I went to pick up Sula to train our organization, I was like, is this book legit? And she said, yes, it's just outdated. So we were trained in with SRA so we could start taking on survivors of SRA. And And so that's how that all started, where we were taking on survivors of SRA in emergency safe house. And so I just became more, I guess, adept at looking for signs, or just kind of knowing what SRA, like what that looked like in survivors.
Can I just ask a couple of questions on that? So what state, was it in Texas, or were you in a different state at the time you were doing that?
Yes, in Texas, in the DFW Metroplex.
Right.
Okay. But we would take survivors from all over the, sure, you know, wherever they would call us from. And we were on our intake form, we were having to say no to SRA because all of our advocates weren't trained in that. And we wanted to stop saying no. And I guess my soapbox is, my argument is that everybody has to be trained up in dealing with SRA because we are seeing it on such a massive level. And I believe that it is being exposed on a massive level at this juncture. So then the Lord had asked us to pivot from safe house, you know, operating a safe house, that we could multiply by training other organizations. Well, insert Carrie and her organization. And in our training, we do some interactive role play. And in that interactive role play was an SRA case. And I could see everyone was just kind of like, what? And that's where, you know, we have to understand what we're dealing with. That human trafficking at its core is a spiritual issue. Mm-hmm. And so I had been digging into your prayers and your podcasts for quite some time. And that's how I started becoming more adept at learning how to handle, you know, cases with SRA. And then, you know, and then Carrie starts another organization. She's possibly going to be opening up emergency care. And so that's kind of where we intersected, is that I was helping train her organization for emergency safe house care.
So let's just rewind back. When you were saying no to a lot of SRA people that were applying for emergency safe housing, before you started saying no, did you say yes to a few and find the circumstances to be overwhelming?
I mean, I believe what safe house or long-term care program has not said yes and been overwhelmed, because people mistake DID for demon possession. And, you know, people don't know what they're dealing with. And if you don't know what you're dealing with, yes, you're overwhelmed. And so I think that when you're properly trained and you know the difference between an altar and the demonic, you have a lot to go on, you know? So for me, I just feel like people are afraid because they don't know. And that's where we have to educate, right? Is that if they have an understanding that they don't have to be afraid, that we do in fact have the authority, I just believe that everyone needs to be trained in how to deal with SRA. And thank goodness for you, because you are a huge part of where I learned that.
That has been one of the things, you know, and we've been consistently keeping that before our face, right? And then one of the things at Bride Ministries that I've been talking about for a long time is we do want to do survivor housing. Mm-hmm. And our vision of survivor housing here has been remediatory. Probably it's going to end up with a mix of offerings at the end of the day to fill several gaps once we perfect, you know, one thing at a time. But working with SRA is a unique bear, because what some people don't realize is, okay, well, you know, you may have someone that seems quite lovely and hurting at the surface, and they apply for help, and it's like, I just need somebody to care about me. And it's like, we want to care. And so you say, yes, we will care for you. But lo and behold, that presenting personality is actually just a shell. The real core personality may actually be a high witch. And so they come into the organization and they have abilities to open up portals. Suddenly everybody's having nightmares. People are triggering all over the place. It's a disaster. And then you destabilize a whole facility because of one person that came in needing just as much help, if not more, than anyone else. And in this scenario, has been reported to me multiple times that people are like, we can't do it. We just have to actually screen for these people. And the problem is that in the world of human trafficking, really more and more of the pimps and more of the groups that are working in organized human trafficking are actually trafficking mind control slaves that are kept in line through mind control techniques involving satanic ritual abuse. So how do we continue to serve the population trying to escape human trafficking without being able to address satanic ritual abuse?
So this is a wildly unpopular opinion. We served one survivor at a time because we understood the implications of parts triggering other parts, and then DID was out of control between, you know, multiple survivors. And we just found that there was a much higher, I guess, success rate in stabilizing with one at a time. And you know, we all want to help as many as we can, right? But if we are not effectively stabilizing and getting them delivered from this atrocity of SRA, are we really helping them by putting them, by gathering as many as we can, and then they're triggering each other, and, you know, one says a word that brings an altar up, that, like, that's a disaster, or it can be a disaster. So I just, again, it's not a popular opinion, but serving one at a time well seemed to do well for us in terms of how they were able to move forward. It's not cost effective, but cost effective versus really helping and healing these survivors. You know, what do you look at?
Fascinating. So Carrie, talk to me a little bit about your experience starting to see SRA among the trafficking population that you were trying to serve. And how did that affect you?
I mean, here's the thing. You guys are on a different level of understanding SRA than I am. This is like I told, like I'm like level one here. I'm really deep diving into this. And I think I'm at a place where God has really opened my eyes to seeing what I didn't understand, but I was like, there's just something not right. There's just something I'm not understanding about their healing. Like, why don't these things work? Why doesn't normal therapy, they say they're doing this, but like, I don't feel like we're having any breakthrough. And some of them maybe even say they are professed believers. And I'm like, I am not, that's not my lane, right? Like I'm very clinical, but like, that's just not something the Lord has really opened my eyes to until I really was working with Carrie Grace Consulting. And like she said, they were doing like a case. And I remember when Amy started, like, she was doing like an SRA type of situation. And I was like, oh, she's playing the psych patient. At first, because my clinical background, the way she was acting was very much like psychosis, right? Like what we label in the ER, like, you know, room two is psychotic. And although we know as a believer, I know this is so much spiritual warfare, you know, whether someone's schizophrenic, bipolar, you know, has 50 medical mental illness diagnosis, I know as a believer, like, this is highly spiritual warfare, right? Rather than organic disease. But I don't think SRA was something I was really in tune with. And so working with Carrie Grace Consulting and then going through some of these things, I was like, oh, wow, this is different. This is a different level. This is a different level of need, and almost like an assessment that somebody who is very educated and aware, like obviously you and Amy, to be interacting with survivors to pick up on things. And Amy was really able to point out some things, even of some survivors I know. And before I could even realize it, I was like, oh, that's why. That's why these things haven't worked. That's why this hasn't worked. Because this is that layer that hasn't been addressed. And it's not going to be addressed in normal therapy. Unless you guys can correct me, but it's not going to happen in normal therapy. It's not going to happen in EMDR. It's just not. There needs to be a whole nother level of care and eyes to really be educated and understand what they're seeing and get them the help they need. And I think, Amy, one of my biggest attractions, to be honest, and yeah, it might not be the most cost effective and it may not be the thing that the way in most people want to open safe houses or initially help and bring stabilization is multiple girls in a home, is that I was really attracted to the individualized care that they give. Because when you talk about the breakthrough that they're receiving in 30 days, because they're the only person, they're the only focus, and they're really working through programs and they're watching everything they do and building rapport, it was just really eye-opening to me. And I do believe that it is probably one of the safer and more effective approaches to helping survivors, especially when they're really coming out of the life, is to have individualized care.
You know, on this subject is where, you know, having the conversation, and I'm gonna let you guys respond to this. One of the things that I believe is that whoever is influencing thought within the helping community is going to either open the door to actual success or close it, because the helping community will then have no choice but to operate out of ignorance. I think that if you go back to, say, the 90s, they had something called the Satanic Panic. And then this group comes out called the False Memory Syndrome Foundation, completely made up. And they just begin their rhetoric to dominate the conversation and say, look, this is not right. People that have memories of satanic ritual abuse must all be making it up, all at the same time, everybody. So universally, we're going to implement care protocols within our psychiatric community to deal with these people saying these things a certain way. And that's going to define how the medical system holistically operates, because you have those that's not my job, turning certain things over to those who are being trained with a certain mindset. And in order to break the system, you actually have to have different training come in to inform those that are in helping roles. And I think that that's only going to happen when other people with a different opinion come in, and those become the logic maps and the resources that are being provided to caregivers and helping agents that just say, no, this is what we think about this. Human trafficking actually does exist. Satanic ritual abuse is an element of human trafficking. These are the signs. And when we train people, we give them that information so that they're not trying to solve a problem with a different set of solutions than are required to actually solve the problem. And, you know, and so I'm going to let you guys kind of respond to that from your observations and give me some feedback.
I mean, I don't know. You said that so well. I agree with you.
Dan is right. Always good to tell a podcaster they're right on their own show. Like, I agree with you, you know, just kidding.
I feel like you might have some other insight on, like, just working with survivors and realizing when it is SRA and when that is there, and like the difference in, you know, their model. You should really speak to this, is like, they have a program, right? And most organizations have a program. You work on it. And it's kind of like the everyday, this is what you do. This is what you do from 9:30 to 10:30. And that acute period when they're first coming out and there's so much trauma, there's so much stuff, they allow them to rest.
Mm-hmm.
They allow them to rest. They are one-on-one. There's nobody to bother them. They get to watch them. They get to go through the program at their own pace. They're still pushing them. They're still encouraging them. But then when they see things like, oh, this might be more of an SRA situation, they pivot and they individualize the care. And they will drop. They just live by the presence and the Holy Spirit. And they drop the check boxes. And they really get down to the root of the problem. And it is really, really refreshing, because I can't say that of a lot of programs I feel like exist, especially in that acute period. Once you've gotten some breakthrough there, then I definitely think they're ready to be engaged and need to be engaged with their community and others and learn how to live with others and be a part of society and do all of those things. But that immediate period, it's a lot to ask of a survivor in general, and then of somebody who has got other kinds of these layers, is just impossible. I feel like in a lot outside of God's power, it's really, it's just too much to ask of them.
Well, let me ask you this. And I have a lot of thoughts about housing and solutions and, you know, I want to ask you this question though. When it comes to peers in the medical community, do you feel that on the journey and trajectory you're on with the human trafficking, providing emergency resources, stabilization, the way that you are beginning to be drawn in this direction, do you feel that most of your peers would look at your trajectory and say, yep, I agree. That's a great direction to be taking things. I am fully behind the way that Carrie is starting to look at these problems. Or would you say that you're starting to inch into that realm of, we don't know about the way that this is going? Just curious.
Yeah. I think when it comes to education and being aware, I think people have always been like, that's such a great cause. That's so noble. You know, like these lots of pats on the back, which is, you know, great. It's fine. I mean, I really don't care whether they care or not, but, you know, that's kind of like, it's a noble cause. It's a human rights issue. Everyone can kind of like relate to that, get behind it. But as years have gone on, I hear a lot of like, oh, you're still doing that? Oh, you're still like, you're still trying to find funding for that? Or, oh, like you really serious about this? I'm like, yeah, because this really happens like every day. And I will tell you on a side note, like if it hadn't been for survivors in my life that I have seen this in reality, I probably would have quit, Dan. I mean, I probably would have. But they are a constant reminder of why it's so important and why these things and these skill sets and this healing is so important for them to get their life back. And we owe it to them. We owe it to them to do this with excellence. And so, I mean, it's kind of evolved. I think now that when you're talking about emergency stabilization, I think generally people know like and can see that those that really need help the most, it is so challenging to get the right help, trying to find shelters, trying to find like all of these different things. And the grant funding of certain places, if you're domestic violence, but they need help, but the overlap can be so mushy sometimes. They're like, oh, well, it's trafficking. If you say the word trafficking, then it's like, oh, well, we don't actually do that. Or I've even heard organizations say our grant doesn't cover that, just domestic violence. And I'm like, what? Like, I just don't even have words. So, I mean, the fact that there's all of these barriers to getting that kind of help, I think people are like, yeah, that needs to happen. We need more of that. We need to be able to put these people and transition them into places that are appropriate for them. But I think when it comes to SRA and talking about that kind of stuff, automatically people start like not looking you in the eyes anymore.
You know, I've even heard it said that for some facilities, they, because insurance, a lot of insurance does not cover dissociative identity disorder or related dissociative problems, people will be misdiagnosed on purpose, bipolar, because that and other similar categorizations will get funding. So even like misdiagnosis is almost financially funded because of the brokenness of the system. What you're saying about grants does not surprise me at all. I've been an advocate for survivors of government project, mind control, satanic ritual abuse for a decade now. Like, I have heard every horror story. Oh my gosh. Now I want to ask another question to you, Amy, because, you know, so you've been doing one-on-one care with Carrie Grace Consulting. You guys do this in Dallas area. So you have 30 days with a person. They come in often, I assume, out of maybe a trafficking situation actively, and they're in a rescue. And so during the time, 30 days with all of that one-on-one, the story, at least in pieces, is going to come out to an extent. Can you give us an idea of the nature of the story that you'll hear in that setting? So you have someone who has a satanic ritual abuse in their background, but they are actively being trafficked. They're getting rescued. What does that story sound like? Are you getting it? It began with familial stuff. I was trafficked by my dad, my uncle, and then I ended up with a pimp. Or do you find that people are more getting like sucked into a world through drugs and abductions, and then ritualized by their traffickers? Just give us an idea.
My experience is by and large familial. Mm-hmm. It seems mm-hmm. SRA seems to have such a massive link to familial trafficking. Mm-hmm. Mothers, which is so mind-blowing, right? But when that should be, for me, a first clue. When they say my mother trafficked me or was involved in my trafficking, that like radar should start going up. You should start paying attention. And then it'll be, well, my family was involved in a cult. Okay, well, that's going to be a massive indicator that it's SRA. And I just want to go back a little bit to a question that you asked. When I would inform programs, long-term programs, for the next steps for the survivor, and about them being, or if I was, vetting them, and I would ask them if they took SRA, and they would be like, well, no. And I'm like, you're taking SRA whether you know it or not. And I think that people desire to know, but they don't know where the training is going to come from. So it's like they just don't know what they don't know. The desire is there once they know that SRA is a thing, and it's, you know, I can't put any type of percentage on it from an educational standpoint, but I just feel like the majority of the survivors that I was seeing, there's some level of SRA there. And people just don't know. So my passion is, can we get these organizations trained up so we can get these women released from the bondage that they're undergoing? But to go back to what you just asked, is that it generally unfolds. One of the things that I noticed is one of our survivors would go to YouTube and pull up music videos. And I was watching, and I'm like, this is bringing out an alter, because I would watch the eyes disconnect. And that to me is a huge indicator too. You watch those eyes go, that's parts. And whether that be from, you know, them dissociating from trauma or intentional programming being put into them, watch the eyes. That's an indicator for me. So watching her go to this music video and seeing the disconnect, and then immediately seeing entities come in and things just start unfolding. You just have to pay attention to things. If it doesn't seem normal, it's not. And I, for me, one of the biggest indicators was family, familial trafficking. And then that always leads into other things where their traffickers was, they were having satanic ritual abuse done to them through traffic, because it's a network, right? It doesn't, it's not, I don't feel like the runaways or whatever, that's a lesser, much smaller degree.
I agree. I mean, and that's been my experience as well. When people have these satanic ritual abuse backgrounds in trafficking or anywhere else, right? It begins early. I mean, yes. Even when you have high level, you know, people, escorts that are servicing the highest levels of politicians and business owners, it's like, well, no, they didn't just wake up and think, oh, wow, I'm really super hot at 18. I'm just going to go this way and service, like, you know, A-lister clients. Like, no, it begins early. Early, and then there's a grooming, and there's a lot of controls put in place, and a person finds their way into that lifestyle most often. And when they're breaking free, the layering of pain and brokenness is extensive. It doesn't get isolated to the trafficking experience in adulthood at all. And I just, you know, I don't understand why this can be the case for anyone that's observing, like really being honest about the problem. It's just one of my biggest struggles, like in my seat, when I look at the problem that I've been faced with, is how is it such an echo chamber when we're all sitting in the same society with the same people that are broken? I mean, is it just that, you know, no one wants the problem to be solved, or that people just have a, like, they cannot add 2 + 2 = 4, you know? And it's just like, well, why don't we have the whole conversation happening if we really want to help people? That's what I keep asking myself. It's like, why can't we just have the whole conversation? Why can't we have the whole conversation? Why do we have to keep oversimplifying the problem, coming up with an incomplete solution and realizing it's not actually helping?
I think because you have, when mm-hmm. you start wanting to have the conversation with people, is it, as you're discovering this issue of human trafficking and SRA, is it then you take layer upon layer and you're like, oh, wow, everything has always been a lie. And the cognitive dissonance that people, it requires cognitive dissonance, I believe, at first for people to even be able to survive, or rather, you can't wrap your minds around that kind of darkness, right? You really can't. And so the echo chamber that you speak of is that people were not equipped to handle that kind of darkness. Like, we were not created for that type of thing. And so only when you understand that it has been every level that has been infiltrated in the world, that's the only time that you can grasp, oh, this really can and does happen. But people just seem to be ready for that conversation. In my case, I don't really care whether people are ready for that conversation, because it's coming to us. Whether we want to, it's going to be force-fed to us because of the exposure that is now taking place, where God is like, we're done. You want to turn a blind eye? You're not going to be able to turn a blind eye. And my heart is, we have to equip people for this mass exposure that is occurring, because we are no good to these survivors if we decide this just feels too much to handle, because God does equip and will absolutely equip. I had no idea about it until 2018, and then God shoved me into the deep end, and I just, like, relentlessly started pursuing and learning and researching, and the prayers and all the once it's level on level on level that gets unwrapped, I believe. And my prayer is that people just are open to taking layer upon layer upon layer. So I would like to have a answer to your question, like, how do we resolve this echo chamber? Because it is highly frustrating.
Right. It's like, yeah, no, I'm actually just venting, but thank you for trying. Right. It's like,
I mean,
you know,
yeah, I feel like conversations like this, where people can understand, you know, carrying the medical on the medical side, is it the medical professionals, there's going to be survivors or people who have been involved in this that are going to send this to medical professionals. And then people that are working within, you know, the restoration aspect that are going to say, oh my gosh, SRA is a thing in our long-term care. And what we thought when we were casting out demons, that like, now they're going to see, I think it's just getting a little piece by piece, and then people will start understanding, okay, this is actually an issue that has to be looked at seriously. And so for me, how is it, do we move forward to train people to adequately deal with this issue of human trafficking, SRA? Mm-hmm. I feel like it's just got to be blasted from the mountaintops, but people have to be well equipped. And had I not been digging into your resources for the years that I've been digging into the resources, I would not have been equipped to deal with survivors of SRA, because some pretty crazy, I have dealt with some pretty crazy entities coming at me where I had to very consciously say, you have authority and you cannot be afraid. They'll try to wear you down, being up till 3 a.m. with the things that are manifesting, and they're going to try to wear you down. But as long as you stand in your authority, and I know because of prayers like yours, I used prayers like yours to help deliver. And so my heart is, I want to get this out on a mass level. It is go time.
Gary, I want to ask you another question. So you have a vision to build emergency stabilization housing solutions, pairing it with medical resources. I want you to talk to us a little bit about your vision.
Well, you know, here's the thing. I feel like it's always been a practical and a spiritual, like to everything, right? Like there's this practical and spiritual. And I've seen the need for placement. We've all seen that. A need for emergency housing, and Carrie Grace Consulting was Freedom Shield, and they were already doing it. And there just needed to be tons more of them. And so really getting to work with them and seeing, okay, like they are the ones to help equip our team to do this and to fill a gap that needs to exist. Now, the medical piece is that whether or not you get to the spiritual levels right away, people want to know that you're taking care of them. They come in and they have so many concerns about their body that haven't been addressed. They don't have a safe place to talk about it. Sometimes they'll hold on to these things forever when, you know, they've have like really serious things that need to be addressed in their lives that they really holds them back from healing. And I feel like medicine is just this very natural way, without talking about Jesus or without talking about, you know, it's just a really awesome platform, to say the least, to come in and just meet their needs, tend to them, make an individualized plan of care. And then that's kind of where it starts. You stabilize, right? Maslow's hierarchy of needs, their shelter, their food, their medical attention. And then once you build that rapport, which is what they were doing, then you get to these deeper levels. Now you get to start seeing them and these spiritual aspects. You've got to see certain things coming forward, and you have this month or so to really get to know somebody. And I mean, I've seen this happen in days, like working with survivors, where you're just seeing being their friend, just being somebody who's willing to listen and attend to these needs, these walls keep coming down because they feel like they're in a safe place. And what if we could do that on a big scale and use medicine and housing to do that? And that's also where breakthrough gets to happen. So we're really placing these women and men where they really need to be for that next step. Because that way they may actually be more likely to say yes to the longer term program because they know they're in a better headspace and they have people that they trust and they know are really fighting for them and in their, you know, they're fighting for them. They need someone to fight for them and really looking for a really good place for them to go. So from that place, you can say, hey, well, we've looked all over the country, which I know Carrie Grace and them have done as their advocates. And after this stabilization period, they're all working for the best place for them to land. And I think that that just speaks volumes to the human spirit, especially someone who's been so traumatized to feel like you've had that one-on-one care and somebody is taking that much time just dedicated to you to find that next step that's best for you and is in your corner. I don't know what human wouldn't be able to experience healing at some level with that kind of model. I don't know if that answers your question.
Very, very good. And I'm excited for something like that. And I think that something is emerging. Eventually, there's going to be executable ideas, I think. And the answer is multiple solutions being merged into a package of resources and response for people. We're drawing it up. Eventually, we are going to do a very large scale at Brad Ministries work, and I want to consider how can we get naturopathic care, actual medical care, working in what we would call inner healing and deliverance, or just more straightforwardly deprogramming, which we are specialists at, and the actual roof over the head, all of these things converging on one, like, you know. And so every time I talk to somebody that has a vision for this or part of it, you know, this is the thing that I am absolutely aware of. There are millions of slaves, even in the United States. And I see a great exodus coming. I see a modern day exodus in the works. You know, God is basically saying, let my people go. And he is going to send judgment, signs and wonders in the heavens and on the earth. Miracles are going to be setting people free. And then they will need to go to a promised land. And, you know, we want to try to help people not spend 40 years in the wilderness. And that's where the solutioning comes in. And so I'm always very excited about anybody whose heart is in this battle and in this space. I want to let you talk a little bit, Carrie, also about your upcoming documentary, because you guys worked on something and I think it's great. So why don't you tell us about it and maybe give us an idea of when that resource is going to come available?
Yeah. Well, okay. Just to go back up one second, I just want to tell both of you, you know, like you're the tools you give in how to deal with somebody programming SRA, like your prayers, your books, like those are what help people move forward and open their eyes, right? So just that awareness is there. It's like, oh gosh, now I see this in people and survivors I've known for a while, and I just didn't see it yet. And so the education you do and the resources you provided, like when she sent me, I think the prayers that shake heaven and earth, you know, I probably had it for a couple of weeks, and like just those resources, like she said, she used your prayers, and I'm like, this is these tools are amazing. These are what, when she says training needs to happen and you're training organizations, these are the tools they need with them so that when they don't know what to do, because we're human and not everyone's going to be a deep dive into SRA, we need to know that we could turn the page to this prayer, and that we have authority, like she said, to read it and to bring authority to what's going on. And so I just want to say, I mean, what you're doing just needs to be on this massive scale where it's involved in all the trainings that things like Carrie Grace Consulting is doing. It is partnering with them to say, like, this piece of education, if you're going to do safe housing, you have to have this in order to open your safe house. No, seriously, there has to be a standard, which is all Carrie Grace training. That is literally, they're bringing what they're, it's called raising the standard, isn't it? Mm-hmm. So I think you guys really need to connect because what you do needs to be required and your resources need to be required for those who are dealing with survivors, without a doubt. So I want to say that, and then I will tell you about a documentary. So it's called Reclaimed, Survivor Stories, and don't quote me on this because there's a lot of footage, but there's probably 12 survivor stories. And these are women who came into a space that we created that was lovely and beautiful. They got taken care of. Their hair was done. Their makeup was done. We had lots of food. We had gift baskets for them. We just made it a beautiful space and said, hey, if you want to come share your story and have a safe place to do that, we would love you, love this opportunity. And I thought we would get a couple. And I had to shut it down because I didn't have enough funds to pay the producer to be there for that many days. And so I had to shut it down at, like, I think the total number was 15 at that point. And was like, we literally wouldn't be able to fit people in. And so each one of them came in the studio. They had their own space. They were allowed to say if they wanted anybody in there, who they wanted. And our team came up with questions that they knew well in advance, just so they could prep and be aware of what they would be asked. But also told, if there's any questions you want us to ask you, things you want to answer, tell us. This is all about you. And so we really personalized what that would look like in the studio, and who they wanted in there. And I will just tell you that in the space, and just God's presence was there, like, nobody kicked people out. Everybody just wanted as many people to be in there was fine. I think they thought this was going to be really like, oh, we don't want anybody here. I don't want to hear my story. It was so complete opposite. There was so much freedom that was being experienced. There was one woman, and then I'll tell you when it's come, I'll tell you a little more details, but there's this one woman, because it's so worth telling this story. She is early 50s. She didn't really recognize she was being trafficked and really spoke about it until she was in a Bible study when she was 46 years old. She was trafficked in the 80s. Somehow she met me on LinkedIn and she saw some overlap with medicine and trafficking. We met. I kind of told her about our organization. We became friends. I told her that we were doing this, Reclaim Stories Survivors. She was all in. She came in the studio and she was just like the sweetest, but like just nervous Nelly, you know? And all of us were just around her, like, just take your time. If you don't even want to do this, you can leave. Like, no judgment. And she just like came in and she sat down. She was just so nervous and we prayed over her. She like invited that. And as she forgot in front of that camera, and she's sitting there, and we asked her one question. And she spoke for 40 minutes. She spoke for 40 minutes like she had been speaking her entire life. She went from the very beginning of her childhood all the way to today in the most seamless, beautiful way. I would, like, we were all blown away. Every one of us was in tears on the sides. And it ends. And she just starts weeping. And she grabs me which I'm like a whole 5 foot, right? She grabs me and like, we both start crying. And she says, I have never felt so free. And I was like, that's it. That was everything. That moment right there, whether we ever get a film, whether we ever, this ever gets in the front of anybody else's eyes, her freedom in telling her story that's been locked up for 52 years, that's worth it. That was everything. So these are the experiences that happened in the studio, which were far greater than anything I could have ever asked or imagined. And so it's with a producer right now from out of California, and he is putting this together. But as we have so much content from survivors that really looking into how to best make that a documentary. And so the goal is that that's what it will look like. And hopefully the goal is that for it to be out this year. But I don't live in production world, but I'm learning that they say this timeline and then it's like 2 months later. So I will send it to you as soon as we know. Hopefully we can have some kind of cool premiere for all the survivors who are part of it and, you know, get to use it however God really wants to use it. I don't even know what that looks like yet, but there's a lot of energy and excitement behind it. And anyone who is a part of it is just excited that their story is going to be told.
Wow.
Yeah.
Well, this has certainly been a very good conversation. I am looking forward to seeing how the Lord continues to use both of you in the veins that he has ordered your steps. And so thank you guys, both of you, for joining me today and for telling all of our listeners that there are more people in this fight. And the army's only growing. So it's a joy to know you guys, and I look forward to keeping up into the future as well.
Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
You bet. Well, friends, that's it for today. Until next time, God bless and Godspeed. You've been listening to Discovering Truth with Dan Duvall. Visit me at danduvall.com, where you'll discover merch, books, and the opportunity to engage in our private social network. Join the tribe by subscribing to our email list and supporting this podcast.